This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. This week, part three of my reading about George Knutson, born in 1922 near Easton, Wisconsin, from the book A Field, Portraits of Wisconsin Naturalists, Empowering Leopold's Legacy, Volume 1, by Sumner Madison. I've read about many people from this book. It's available on Amazon and is published by Little Creek Press, Mineral Point, Wisconsin, in 2020. And Sumner assures me that he's working on the much-anticipated Volume 2. I can't thank you enough, Sumner, for your vision and the windows into naturalist lives you have given us. Last week was Part 2, where we learned about some of George Knutson's great teachers at UW-Madison, among them Aldo Leopold, John Curtis, and Norman Fassett. And we learned of his chance visit with Frank Lloyd Wright on the veranda of Wright's home near Spring Green. They talked about beavers and cicadas and drank lemonade. This week, a couple of stories about his research on bears, his deep interest in hard work in our state parks. He combined education, ecology, art, and trail design to enhance our visits to our beautiful state parks. And lastly, a moving coincidence during a visit to the cemetery where Frank Lloyd Wright was buried, for a time, not far from Taliesin. Sumner conducted this interview in 1984. I conducted research on beaver, bear, and otter during the years 1950 to 1962. I studied the three species in all parts of their range because the DNR wanted to obtain as much information as possible for future management purposes. I put in very long hours, often starting at 5 or 6 in the morning and finishing at dusk. The work on black bear occurred from 1958 to 1962. At that time, we didn't know much about our black bear population. I was asked if I wanted to switch over to studies on them for a year or two. I said yes. As with all research projects, when you don't know that much about a species, you study every aspect you can. So I plunged ahead with a status survey, a range survey, and a study on food habits. The bear study was basically in the northern two tiers of counties, all the way across the north. But we concentrated our trapping efforts in Bayfield, Douglas, and Washburn counties in the northwest, and in Forest, Vilas, and Oneida counties in the northeast. We wanted to study movements because in those days there were people worried about shooting all the bears. I wanted to find out as much as I could about bear movements for the simple reason that we trapped, and the DNR still does, complaint bears. I wanted to know how far we had to haul a bear and release it so it wouldn't raise another complaint. I didn't want to trap a bear and shoot it. That had been happening a lot. I couldn't see wasting bears like that when we could determine how far we had to go to release them. I wanted to find out how far they moved in a certain period of time. We found out that there was a tremendous amount of movement, especially among the males. With males, we got an average yearly move of 18 miles. That's half a county. They go across that county, find a few female residents, and have cubs to bolster the bear population. When you have a good, viable population, that's the time to study them, not when they're going downhill. I trapped in many different areas and amassed my data to obtain averages on a county-by-county basis. Bruce Cohn, about 20 years later, wanted to take a very small area in Iron County and see how many bears he could trap out of that area, which he did for 3 years. He had all kinds of repeat trapping. The interesting thing is the movements were about the same as mine 20 years after my study. In the best bear habitat, I had one bear for every 1 to 2 square miles. His saturation study came out with 1.6 bear per square mile. That's when research really means something, when it's corroborated somewhere down the line by somebody else. One of my favorite stories involves a bear at the Dairy Farm Resort up by Boulder Junction. There was a dump right behind the resort that bears used. So we thought we'd come up and try to live trap around the dump. They were open dumps in those days. We really had a bonanza with bears. So we drove to this dump. The tourists staying at the resort, knew we were coming somehow. We drove into the dump and looked over the bear sign. People came up to us, telling about the big tracks, the little tracks, about the weight of this one and that one. We told them that maybe we would come back in a few days and set one of our big culvert traps. So we did. We came back a few days later, and of course we drove in. The tourists saw us coming, and the whole dang bunch got in their cars. Some walked from the resort down to the dump. We must have had 15 to 20 people down there. When we approached the dump, there was a bear there that was a pretty tame old gal. I turned to Dewey and said, "Gosh, there's only that one tree. Maybe if I chase her, she'd go up that tree and we can get her without even trapping her." So I took off out of the truck. People started yelling and clapping, me after the bear. The bear scooted out and up the dang tree just as nice as could be. So here's the bear sitting up in the tree with no trap, nothing to keep the bear from coming down. But when there's a crowd like that, you know, and you've got a chance to get a bear for free, I thought, hell, it's worth the chance. So I climbed up under this bear with my needle and got right up under her fanny and gave her a little shot. She blew at me, and I thought, boy, if she starts climbing down, she's going to use me as part of the tree. But she just stayed up there, and pretty soon she started quivering. Well, then she started slipping, and down she came right beside me. She was a big one, probably about 180 pounds. I put my arm around her, and both the bear and I skidded down that tree. Those people watching had eyeballs that big watching me, a big Norwegian coming down the tree with that bear. Of course, I couldn't hold 180 pounds. It was mostly a scrambling fall for about 15 feet. The bear was out when we got down there. I was a big hero that day, so from that time on, every time I was up in that country club area, people would say, "There's the guy that climbed the tree and got that live bear." I got to tell you one more. We were called by the warden at Mercer one day. He asked if we'd come up and trap a few bears out of the dump because they were getting too thick in there. They were coming into town at night and disturbing and scaring people. We trapped three or four of them and took them varying distances and released them. The last one we caught was a big male. He weighed maybe 375 pounds. As we became more experienced, we only gave them enough of the drug to take them where we wanted to release them and let them go. So we drugged this 375-pounder relatively lightly and headed toward Bass Lake, about a half hour away. We struggled to lift him into the back of the pickup, closed the tailgate, and left the dump. We hit a bunch of bumpy roads. All of a sudden, the truck lurched, and I looked through the back window just over the stock rack. That big fool was trying to climb out of the back of the truck right on the highway, so I yelled, "Jaeger, stop this damn truck!" We stopped, and I jumped back there. I knew I could do this because a drug bear is just like a drunken man for at least 45 minutes and won't try to bite. He struggled to climb out, however, and I tried to pull him back in. What a struggle! I wrestled with that bear. The bear broke one of the boards on the stock rack. I yelled to Jaeger to get going. I continued to fight, when all of a sudden I was aware of a car right behind the truck. I looked up, and there were two elderly people, a man and a woman, and a big Chrysler. I swear I saw four saucer-sized eyeballs. They couldn't believe that there's a man in the back of a moving pickup wrestling a bear. Shortly after that, we turned off toward Bass Lake and headed into the woods. "He's getting too smart," I yelled out. "Stop!" We came to a halt, and I kicked him in the rear. He wandered off, stumbling through the brush. I often wonder what those two people had to say about this incident. They didn't follow us, but I bet to their dying day they told that story many times. Silly fool in the back of a pickup wrestling a big bear. After I finished with the bear studies, I went on to the Bureau of Parks and Recreation as chief naturalist. When I developed the DNR's interpretive program in 1962, I created four sections. The most important one of all was the guided hike. That's where you see nature firsthand. You can smell it, touch it, watch it wave in the breeze, see its beauty, its grace, its color, and its adaptations. Every time I talked about a species, I tried to put a value on it. For instance, its value as wood, fruit, seeds, or as a useful chemical. I emphasize the aesthetic value, too. Take a mushroom like the Amanita, which so many people like to destroy. I'd say Look at it. Isn't it beautiful? Wouldn't it make a beautiful photograph with the sun shining on it through the maple leaves? I did a lot of that. Next in importance in my interpretive program was the labeled nature trail. In the beginning, I was trying to figure out the best way to lay out a nature trail for the guided hikes. What was the best way to lay out a nature trail to hold labels? What are the best labels? I spent one whole winter with plastics and laminates trying to come up with durable labels. The one I finally came up with is weatherproof and vandal resistant. There's nothing that's really vandal proof. Then I studied audiovisual techniques, how to make displays and exhibits. After I studied these things, I began to put them into our first small nature centers. It was just a matter of developing all the methods and techniques for self-guided hikes, writing my nature hike theme booklet, and writing instructions for each naturalist. I trained the seasoned naturalists that came in June and go through Labor Day, and I trained the permanent naturalists as we hired them. The very first trail I put in was located right behind the Nature Center and the Pine Stand at Devil's Lake State Park. That didn't last very long. It was vandalized. That's when I realized that I had better get some better labels than what I had. I had used plywood with label varnish overcoat. The vandals peeled this off and nothing flat. The next trail was in Governor Dodge State Park, then Wyalusing and Peninsula. I hit the big properties first. They had priority. I designed the entire trail at Governor Dodge and put up the labels. When I went to the parks, I'd often get up at the crack of dawn and wouldn't leave until after dark sometimes. I studied the layout of the parks to figure out where to design a nature trail, where to build a nature center, what was unique about that park. Never did anyone ask me how many hours I was spending doing all of this work, including all of the nature trail drawings I did at home during nights, often until midnight. I've always been artistically inclined. I like to draw. When I was a youngster, I'd lie on the living room floor on cold winter days and draw things. And then, in entomology, I did several detailed drawings. The more I drew an insect, the more I knew it. When we finally hired limited-term employees, LTEs, I knew what to tell them. Many didn't know much about interpretation, but they had a lot of coursework. They were tremendously interested in the outdoors. Often on the trail, I told them I was going to quiz them. I'm going to tell you what this is, its value, how it fits in, what its phenology is, whatever. Down the line, I'm going to point it out again. And you better remember, I always had them carry a Sears catalog with them. That way, when they found a plant they didn't know, they could pick a leaf or whatever was characteristic, place it in there, and write a name on that page. Then they'd go home and on occasion flip through the pages. They would not look at the name first, but look at the plant and remember. This was a good way to teach them quickly. One of the most important things I've learned from all of the years in the field is that nature is involved in a great big struggle. It's a struggle of life against death, and every insect, every whale, every seal, every tern is on a razor's edge right now. We never know when we will fall off and die. In a 24-hour period, there are millions of deaths because it's been shown by an English study that in a diversified acre of open field with some shrubbery, there are 100 to 400,000 spiders and spiderlings, and each of them is feeding on something each day. Plus you have the dragonflies, the ambush bugs, the swallow, the bat. The diversity of nature is a miraculous thing. But the natural fact of mortality in the natural world is not an excuse for permitting habitat destruction. I'll put money toward environmentally sound programs to buy that marsh or buy that forest or buy that bog, whatever it might be, especially to protect endangered species. If good naturalists and good interpreters could get a hold of every person on this earth and spend a week with them, we would have a much better chance of saving species and saving communities. I sincerely feel that if people desire to save themselves and our ecosystems, they must learn more about them. With study comes understanding. With understanding comes appreciation. And with appreciation comes reverence for and the desire to protect. I'll tell you about one coincidence that still makes me wonder about what the heck is going on. One fall in New Glarus, my wife Arlene entered the New Glarus Arts and Crafts Show. I helped her set up and was there all day. That fall, the woman right next to us was a calligrapher and an artist. So I'm sitting there and finally felt compelled to go over and read what she had on this one painting. The painting was a beach scene with trees. It broke into a strand and then into a scene where there were unicorns, a stylized mythological rendition. That caught my eye. I went to the calligrapher and said, "You do nice work." Then I read the poem she had calligraphed onto the painting. I got a lump in my throat. It spoke to what I've always felt about where I'm going after I leave this earth. Here's the poem. It's called Part of the Sky. This body I live in is not really mine, just a home that I've borrowed. I'll return it sometime. Death does not haunt me. I will never die, because I'm part of the earth and I'm part of the sky. When my body lies empty, I'll find a new home, give back to the earth my flesh and my bones, return what was borrowed. But don't stop to cry, because I'm part of the earth and I'm part of the sky. And on some dark night, when you start wondering why, look at the stars in the clear midnight sky. We all move in circles. It's just something you learn. Death is not dying. It's just my time to return. And if you start wondering just where I might be, look at the showers and leaves on the tree. Look at the rivers and mountains and seas. That's where I am, and that's where I'll be. I'll be in the thunder and the rain and the night. I'll be in the sunrise and the first song of light. I'll be in the forest and the birds as they fly, 'cause I'm part of the earth and part of the sky. I read that and nearly bawled right there, because it so perfectly mirrored what I have thought and communicated to people. I told her it was the most beautiful thing I ever read. I asked her who wrote it. She said it was written by a 25-year-old man named Sidney Makepeace Wood III, just before he died in 1975. Then last fall, Arlene and I took an old army buddy and his wife to where we thought we could find Frank Lloyd Wright's grave. We found it. There were nice big bricks around it. Many of his relatives and non-relatives were buried in the same cemetery. We spent about half an hour there, and then we started heading back to the car. Off to the right, out in the grass, there was a lone gravestone. I felt a compulsion to go over and see who was buried there. I walked over and yelled for Arlene to come over. On the gravestone's heading was Sidney Makepeace Wood III, Part of the Sky. Out of all the places in the United States where he could have been buried, and after that poem, here, I had been drawn right over to that grave. Incredible. I keep thinking that maybe someday he'll materialize and I'll get a chance to talk with him. To write that poem, he had to have a feeling at his young age for something that I've developed all through these years. The thing is, he's buried on the same property with Frank Lloyd Wright. Maybe he was family. I've always felt that I don't want to be buried. I want to be cremated and want to get right back into the earth's system. I feel that I'm from everywhere on this earth. I've thought this many times. There are molecules of me from Australia. There are molecules I sweated out 2 years ago that are probably passing by a gray whale right now. We all come from somewhere. This has been a part of my philosophy of life. I'd like to go by wandering off into some bog and have moss grow over me so I could never be found. But they'd say, "We don't want you Norwegians polluting the North Woods." No, the only way I really want to go is down here on a sandbar, line my canoe with some nice big creosoted railroad ties, lay me on it, light that baby a fire, and shove it out into the river. That's the way the Norwegians went to Valhalla. And Sumner writes, at the end, surrounded by his family, George passed away in Verona, Wisconsin, on October 24, 2004, at age 82. Can there be any doubt that he was warmly received in Valhalla? And I've done a little bit of looking into the people buried at the Frank Lloyd Wright Cemetery, and Sidney Makepeace Woods III's grandmother was a Lloyd Jones, Alice Lloyd Jones. So he was part of the Frank Lloyd Wright family. I've been reading from the book A Field, Portraits of Wisconsin Naturalists, Empowering Leopold's Legacy, Volume 1, by Sumner Mattison. Sumner's last name is spelled Mattison. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.